Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, January 27, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Our call today is entitled Government Rights and Government Wrongs and Victims' Rights. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. And we're happy and pleased to welcome back to the teleforum format today the Honorable Paul G. Cassell. He's the Ronald M. Boyce Presidential Endowed Chair in Criminal Law at the University of Utah College of Law. His bio was provided to you in the information that announced today's call, so we're going to get right to the substance. He's going to give us some opening remarks on the topic of about 15 minutes or so, but then, as always, we're going to be turning to the audience for questions, so please do be ready with your questions when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Professor Cassell, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Dean, and I'm talking about something that I think is fairly timely. Tomorrow, Loretta Lynch will be going in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee in connection with her nomination to be Attorney General of the United States. And I want to talk about a particular case that in some ways predated Ms. Lynch's tenure at the Eastern District of New York, but also spanned her tenure there. And I think it raises some important questions that the Senate ought to ask her while she's testifying tomorrow, or perhaps in terms of a follow-up written question. It involves some important issues of crime victims' rights, and it's a particular defendant that I will call John Doe. His name is out there in the public record. It's not too hard to find on Google, but at some points in the proceedings, it's been sealed. So let's just talk about Mr. John Doe, who pled guilty in 1998 to racketeering for running a stock fraud that ended up swindling, about $40 million from various victims. Doe then provided cooperation with the government, and in 2004, he came up for sentencing. Because he'd been such an important cooperator for the government, the U.S. Attorney's Office there in the Eastern District of New York did not provide a list of Doe's victims to the probation office. And, of course, without a list of victims, the probation officer wasn't able to contact the victims, wasn't able to come up with any kind of a restitution order, even though, as I'll explain in a moment, restitution for this racketeering offense that Doe had pled guilty to was mandatory. Well, things dragged on for a while, and finally, about 5 years later, in 2009, Doe was sentenced. He was not sentenced to pay any restitution to his victims, even though he'd stolen about $40 million from them. Doe's victims received no notice of this sentencing, even though the Crime Victims Rights Act, as I'll talk about, requires that victims get notice of all public court proceedings. Well, at that point, he shouldn't have been able to have been involved in further crimes. His business career should have been over with a felony on his record. But the government concealed the fact that Doe was a convicted felon. And Doe wasted little time getting back to his old tricks and starting to defraud new victims. And by 2002, he'd infiltrated a real estate venture and was using it to launder tens of millions of dollars, defraud millions of dollars more in cash for himself. And an attorney that I'll call Richard Rowe, and again, Richard's name is out there in the public light as well, but Richard Rowe started getting wind of this. In fact, a whistleblower gave him some documents unsolicited about some of these earlier crimes, including a pre-sentence report from the earlier conviction that Doe had had. This revealed that Doe was hiding his conviction from his partners at his new firm. And so based on this information, Attorney Rowe filed a RICO complaint on behalf of Doe's victims in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York. At that point, rather than taking steps to try to help the victims that have been defrauded in these cases, both the District Court in the Southern District of New York and the District Court in the Eastern District of New York swung into action and tried to punish Rowe for concealing this, for revealing the crime that had been committed earlier by John Doe. The Southern District of New York sealed the civil RICO complaint within 4 days, and the Eastern District of New York Court issued a temporary restraining order barring Rowe from disseminating any information about all this. There were some proceedings challenging this on First Amendment grounds in the Second Circuit, and I should make clear I helped Richard Rowe briefly on the Second Circuit proceedings, Second Circuit affirmed all these sealing orders, and then the case went to the Supreme Court. Roe filed a cert petition there, raising First Amendment arguments and crime victims' rights arguments. There again, I filed a brief in that case. I filed a brief for the National Organization for Victim Assistance, saying that victims need to be notified about these kinds of crimes, and you can't simply avoid restitution by keeping the entire case under seal. Paul Clement helped to represent Richard Roe in that case as well. The Solicitor General filed a brief in opposition to the cert petition and, interestingly, did not say one substantive word about whether the victims' rights had been violated, did not say how the government, if at all, had complied with the victims' rights statutes. And the Supreme Court ultimately denied review. And the case has continued in various forms to chug along in the Eastern District of New York and the Southern District of New York. But what I want to talk about is, I think, some important crime victims' rights issues that arise in this case and perhaps in others as well. I mentioned that the crime that John Doe pled guilty to was a fraud crime, a racketeering crime in particular, and that triggers an obligation under the Mandatory Victims' Rights Act for the court to order restitution in that case. As the title of the act suggests, restitution is mandatory. It's not one of those situations where the judge can pass or play or weigh the equities and decide whether or not he wants to order restitution. He has to order restitution. And indeed, the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure require that there be a pre-sentence report that lists all the financial information about a crime, the effects that it's had on victims, and so forth. And so when Doe was sentenced in the Eastern District of New York, the district court was required to at least evaluate all the restitution claims and provide notice to victims, and ultimately, I think, to order restitution for any losses that could be proven. However, apparently the government was very interested in securing cooperation from John Doe. So, of course, it did none of that. And the result was that essentially the government, I guess, took $40 million, which wasn't its money. It was crime victims' money that had been stolen, and handed it over to John Doe to exchange for him being a cooperator with the government. And I think that's the question that Loretta Lynch should be asked tomorrow. It's one thing for the government to offer incentives for people to cooperate with the government, but the government shouldn't be able to offer incentives that involve other people's money. The government shouldn't be able to tell a bank robber, for example, that, hey, if you'll cooperate with us, you can keep all the money that you stole from the bank. And similarly here in this Doe case, the U.S. Attorney's Office, which Loretta Lynch was running during parts of the time that this case was moving forward, was not free to tell Doe that he could keep millions of dollars he'd stolen rather than pay it back to the victims. There's one other piece of the case that I think is worth highlighting, and that's the Crime Victims' Rights Act, the CVRA. The CVRA was passed in 2004. It's an important federal statute. It contains a Bill of Rights for crime victims. And basically the idea behind the law was that crime victims should not be kept in the dark about crimes that have been committed against them. Instead, they should receive a notice of court hearings. They should have the opportunity to attend those hearings. And at particular points in the process, they should have the opportunity to even speak at those hearings. For example, during a plea bargain or at sentencing, they should have the opportunity to tell the judge what the defendant's crime has done to them, to ask for restitution, ask for a long prison sentence, any of those things. Of course, none of those things happened in this particular case. John Doe was sentenced in 2009, and at that point, the case, it's not clear whether it was a public case or not. The U.S. Attorney's Office seems to have taken the position that it was a public sentencing. And if it was a public sentencing, then the government was obligated to notify all of John Doe's victims about the sentencing, make arrangements for them to come and attend the court hearing if they wanted. But so far as appears in any of the records in this case, the U.S. Attorney's Office never notified any victim about what was going on. It basically wanted to keep this whole thing under wraps, and whether it formally sealed the sentencing or, in practical terms, sealed the sentencing by not telling anyone what was happening, the upshot is that so far as the record reveals, not a single victim was notified about what happened. In addition, the government would have been obligated to provide some information about how to obtain restitution to these victims. None of that was done. Now, this is one case, the case involving John Doe. So you might say, well, maybe there was some mistake in this situation. I have to say that I don't think that's the case. From everything I have seen in the records, there was a business-as-usual feel to what was going on in this case. It looked like the prosecutors in the courts were doing something that was rather routine. And so that, to my mind, raises very serious concern that maybe the U.S. Attorney's Office in this case was allowing a criminal to keep money that he stole from a crime victim as a way to secure something of use to the government cooperation from that defendant. One of the things that I think should happen tomorrow or over the next couple of days is that Loretta Lynch should be asked questions about this. I tried to blow the whistle on all this, if you will, in April of 2002. I had many of these facts. Some of them had been revealed in the court pleadings, and so I was aware that there were sealing orders out there that restricted the ability of people to comment on some of these things. Not wishing to violate any sealing orders, I was preparing testimony for the House Judiciary Committee, and I put together a full draft of my testimony that included a section discussing this case. And in April of 2012, I sent it to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York, which, of course, was run by Loretta Lynch at that time. I said, look, I want to provide this information to Congress. I want you to look at it and make sure that I'm not violating sealing orders. However, the U.S. Attorney's Office there said, well, we can't comment on this case because it's sealed. You might be violating a sealing order if you move forward. And it essentially, in my view, was threatening me with prosecution if I should try to blow the whistle on what was happening. So at that point, I contacted the general counsel's office here at the University of Utah and requested their assistance in trying to provide this information to Congress. The general counsel for the University of Utah, John Morris, sent a series of letters to the judges involved in the case, and in particular to the U.S. Attorney's Office, that would be Loretta Lynch's office, trying to get some clarity on what things I could say or could not say, trying to get some clarity on how I could alert Congress to this violation of the Crime Victims' Rights Act. And through a series of evasions, the U.S. Attorney's Office essentially was never able, or never willing, I guess I should say, to tell me whether or not my testimony would be consistent with sealing orders, and as a result, I was not able to provide that information to Congress in 2012. Congress held another victims' rights hearing in April of 2013, and again, I sent a request to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York for their assistance in trying to provide this information to Congress. At this point, they continued to provide evasive answers, saying they can't give me. They told me they could not give me any advice on these subjects. And at that point, I decided to simply put together testimony that had what I thought was public record information revealing the entire saga. And so, I provided that to the House Judiciary Committee in April 2013, encouraging the committee to contact the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York to investigate all this, and there seems to have been now perhaps not a lot of follow-up a year and a half ago, but hopefully some follow-up now. Hopefully there will be some interest in asking Loretta Lynch about her role in all this and more broadly about how are crime victims being treated in these cases when the proceedings are under seal, where defendants have stolen money from victims. Is the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York allowing bad guys to keep money that they've stolen from victims in exchange for cooperating with the government? I think that raises very serious questions that the Senate Judiciary Committee should discuss. So that's an overview of the issue I wanted to present, and happy to entertain any questions about the particular case or more broadly about crime victims' rights.
Well, thank you so much for those opening remarks. We've got quite a few people on the call. Let's open it up to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So let's open up the floor. So once again, if you have a question for our experts today, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And before we go to our first caller, let me make a quick announcement about upcoming Teleforum conference calls we have on our schedule. Tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about the Nebraska Supreme Court's decision in the Keystone Pipeline case. It's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Then on Thursday at 12 noon, again Eastern Time, we'll be speaking with former Attorney General Edwin Meese. He'll be talking about voter ID laws and voter fraud. That's Thursday at noon. And then Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be recapping the Supreme Court's decision in Teva Pharmaceuticals. That's yet another patent case that the Supreme Court has handed down. Each one of those telephone conference calls and some additional calls that are already scheduled for the weeks following, you can get details on those on the Federalist Society's website. But today, of course, we're talking with Judge Paul Cassell and Professor Paul Cassell. I wonder if you want to, while we're waiting to see if others have questions, is this a phenomenon, this sort of case, that have you heard about this happening in other U.S. Attorney's Office, or is this a case type that's peculiar to that U.S. Attorney's Office? Is this a practice that goes beyond this U.S. Attorney's Office?
Well, it's hard to get a handle on exactly what's happening here because this case is under seal, and of course other cases like it would be under seal as well. One thing I can say, I was a federal district court judge out here in the District of Utah for about 5.5 years from 2002 to 2007, and I certainly never saw anything like this practice, sealing a case and then using the fact that it was sealed to basically deprive the victims of restitution. Now, I'm aware, of course, that the docket that we have out here in the District of Utah is not entirely the same as the docket out in the Eastern District of New York or Southern District of New York. Far more organized crime cases in those districts than we have out here. But nonetheless, I have some familiarity with the dockets around the country, and it seems to me that maybe this is confined to the Eastern District of New York or perhaps the Southern District of New York as well, that there seem to have been a new set of rules that, frankly, run afoul of in my view, the First Amendment, the Crime Victims' Rights Act, the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act, that allow the government to secure cooperation from individuals to not play by the rules, to hand over victims' money to criminals. And I think that that issue needs some serious exploration.
Once again, we're talking to former judge and professor Paul Cassell. If you have a question for him, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines are going to be open. Let's take our first call of the day.
David Emerson, Society member here in Berkeley, California. I've got a couple of questions to address. One of them has to do with, you know, if the victims in this case were completely unaware that they had been harmed, and I could sort of see the reason for having to be notified by the government. But in a case like you're describing where there's substantial financial loss, why wouldn't just the normal mechanism of their being aware that they had lost their money in a civil lawsuit, perhaps, conjunction with a number of the damaged plaintiffs here, be a sufficient remedy for that? Would the statute of limitations pass, or is there some other reason that that wouldn't be viable? And the second question I have has to do with not cases where a party has been adjudged guilty, but the identity is concealed, but in cases where the government kind of cuts a different deal, either deferred prosecution or a non-prosecution entirely, where there's no notice to the harmed parties, but the government decides that perhaps they're going after bigger fish and they want to cut a deal. So there would be no triggering of the victim restitution statute in the first place. What do you think about those other cases?
Thanks. Those are both great questions. Let me take them in order. The first situation, where the victim's entirely unaware of the harm here, and I think a lot of times victims are aware of the harm. What they're not aware of is the identity of the perpetrator. So there was my understanding of the facts here is that there was this fraud involving literally tens of millions of dollars, and what wasn't clear immediately was who was responsible for that. And once the government apprehended the perpetrator and had him plead guilty, at that point there would have been the opportunity for restitution. And restitution, by the way, that would have been fairly simple for the victims to obtain. All they would have to show is document their losses to the probation office. And then one of the nice things from a victim's perspective is that the probation office takes the laboring oar in collecting that money from the defendant and otherwise passing the money along to the victims. Of course, a civil suit requires a tremendous expenditure of time and energy, and it isn't always certain whether whether there will be any recovery. So that a civil suit is always a possibility. It just, in many cases, isn't a realistic one, either because there doesn't appear to be an identified defendant or perhaps attorneys unwilling to take the case on a contingency or whatever might be required. Your second question is an interesting one, too. What about a situation where the government decides to cut a deal, maybe a non-prosecution deal or something like that that avoids the filing of criminal charges, and therefore the victim's well, the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act, for example, is not triggered. I think that that's a situation where it's quite important that the victim's rights statute be complied with. What the government should do if it's cutting that kind of a deal is notify the victims, and then they would be in a position to maybe persuade the prosecution not to do that. If there is some, let's say, a plea to a small charge, perhaps the victims could object to that and then persuade the judge not to accept that kind of a plea deal. You may be aware I'm pursuing a case down in the Southern District of Florida that involves a non-prosecution deal, and the victims that I represent there are making exactly that kind of an argument, that the non-prosecution agreement should have been invalidated and that the government failed to confer with them, and as a result, they should be entitled to various remedies. So it is true that if the government decides not to file charges, the victim's ability to challenge that is very limited, but there is at least some possibility of either trying to persuade the government or persuade a court that that the disposition the government's coming up with is inappropriate.
Once again, if you have a question, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We do have one more question pending. After that, our lines are open. Let's take another call here.
Paul, this is Fred Oberlander. I didn't catch the beginning of it. I had a problem logging on. I just wanted to add a very brief comment to your answer to the last question. And if you didn't mention any names, the floor should understand that I'm one of the attorneys litigating that particular case. But a direct answer is that at least here in New York, most of the criminal acts that would be implicated with this problem are charged and pled to as racketeering. And you can't bring, generally, a racketeering lawsuit for securities fraud-related crimes unless there's first been a criminal conviction. So to the gentleman who asked, it's not just in our case, but in general, you will find that even if you know who the ringleader was or some of the other participants, unless there has been an actual criminal conviction that has gone through to the sentencing stage, you have no statutory standing to bring the action. So by hiding some of the perpetrators and by hiding the fact not only of their conviction but eventual sentencing, they've not only eliminated the knowledge of the conviction, they've eliminated all practical ability to sue for it. And in the interest of full disclosure, we represent some of the stock fraud victims 20 years later who were just held to have timely filed their suit because the sentencing was delayed so long for 15 years that the statute of limitations in the civil suit didn't even apply until the sentencing. So it's kind of a mistake for the government. But I just wanted to gently point out that the civil actions are, as Paul said, extremely expensive. And finally, at least around here, the peppercorn of proof necessary to establish restitution during a sentencing generally comes under the standards of a Fatigo hearing, which are going to be typically far less burdensome than would be the case in Rule 9B in proving fraud and establishing damages in a civil action. Thank you.
Paul Cassell, anything to add to that comment?
Yeah, no, I think Fred is pointing out, you know, what the real world lawyer can do that. Look, a lot of times the choice isn't between restitution recoveries for the victim and civil recoveries for the victim. The choice is between restitution or no recovery for the victim. Frequently, victims are not going to get anything at all if they're forced to file some kind of a civil lawsuit, which is one of the reasons that Congress has provided for restitution and, indeed, in many situations, made restitution mandatory. And so that's what's so disappointing about what's happened in this case is basically the U.S. Attorney's Office has taken a mandatory restitution statute and buried it, eviscerated it, so that no restitution at all was ordered in this particular case.
You, By the way, for our audience, again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our floor mode is open, is on, so feel free to weigh in here with your questions. You've mentioned the Mandatory Victims Restitution Act a couple of times here. What if you want to give us some background on that and say a little bit more about that act and its requirements?
Sure. The act was passed in 1996, and the basic genesis for it was that Congress looked into the restitution situation and discovered that even though there were a number of statutes on the books that called for restitution, a lot of judges were simply not ordering restitution at all. It was too complicated or too time-consuming, or some of the judges were saying, and I think Congress decided as a country we're going to invest the time and invest the energy that's needed to make sure that victims get full compensation. And so in 1996, Senator Hatch and others in Congress put together the MVRA, and it says that for certain crimes, and racketeering is one of them, a judge shall order restitution. It shall take the time to go through and figure out exactly what kind of a restitution order is obligated. And that's what I think makes the U.S. Attorney's Office's actions in this case so disturbing, is in the face of a federal statute that Congress has enacted, the president has signed into law, that says whenever someone is convicted of these kinds of crimes, they will have to pay full restitution. The U.S. Attorney's Office has figured out a way around it, and I think it's an illegal way around that statute, and that's something that Congress needs to investigate.
And I take it, Professor Cassell, this is not a case where there's conflicting mandatory requirements placed on the U.S. Attorney's Office. That is where they're required to look at the restitution, but they're also maybe required to do something that conflicts with that. On the other hand,
no. Let me be clear. I am not someone who says the government should never be getting a cooperator to provide information. And there may even be cases, obviously, where somebody's going to cooperate on very serious matters. Their name, may have to be kept secret. That's all fine. But there are ways where we can have our cake and eat it too, so to speak. For example, in this case, if the government felt like the cooperator's name couldn't be disclosed to the public, they could have provided information to the victim saying Mr. John Doe is going to be sentenced on a certain day, and if you put in your restitution claims, we will ask the probation office to collect money from John Doe and then take that money and pass it on to you. There are ways of handling those sorts of things that accommodate the government's interest in protecting its cooperators while at the same time accommodating the needs of the victims to get restitution. What's disappointing here is that the government seems to have given exclusive priority to its interest in getting a cooperator to provide some information and completely ignored the victim's interest. There doesn't seem to have been any effort to try to balance the two concerns and to make sure that the victims at least got something back. And remember, this isn't a case where somebody was trying to get restitution from a criminal who had no assets whatsoever. The record discloses that this was a cooperating individual who had some very substantial resources, essentially, from what I can tell, was living the high life off of the victim's money. And that just isn't right, and the prosecutor should have addressed that concern at least in some way.
Very good. We've got a couple questions pending now, so let's return to our audience.
Hi, my name is Benjamin Dinkin from New York. I was wondering, Professor, you mentioned that you had brought this to the attention of the House Judiciary Committee. Why do you think it is, at least, that they haven't taken more significant interest in what seems to be a lack of execution on what they've passed, the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act, in the U.S. Attorney's offices?
Yeah, that's a good question. Obviously, you might have to ask some of the folks in the committee. Just a little bit of background. I mean, I provided my testimony. You can find it on a website somewhere, but it was with regard to a House Judiciary Committee hearing in front of the Subcommittee on the Constitution on April 25th, 2013. And it was about the proposed Victims' Rights Amendment, a proposed amendment to the United States Constitution that would protect victims' rights. And one of the questions you get in a lot of cases is, well, why do you need to amend the Constitution? Can't we pass statutes to protect victims' rights, and don't the statutes do the job by themselves? And I offered this case as an illustration of a situation where I think a statute was simply being ignored. I think in fairness to the House Judiciary Committee, you know, they get a lot of people saying, hey, look into this, look into that, and they may have just had other fish to fry at that time. But I'm hoping that with U.S. Attorney Lynch's confirmation hearing starting tomorrow, that that would be a perfect occasion for some of the senators, either in the oral testimony or in written questions, to ask about this and see what's going on. Again, the government's had a number of opportunities to say, look, this is how we complied with the statutes, or this is what we were doing, but the government just hasn't said a word about this, which frankly makes me very suspicious that there's no explanation whatsoever for what they're doing.
We've still got two questions pending, so let's carry on here.
Yes, if I can ask an additional question to Professor, more of a general question about victim restitution. And it, in the case of where there's multiple instances of wrongdoing, which is often the case, for example, financial fraud, and there are series of frauds that have occurred over a period of years, the government may be in a position where it just wants to choose the easiest one to prove up. And it identifies a subset of the group of victims who would arguably get preferential treatment under victim restitution. So what are your thoughts about the equities of that and the government making those sort of choices, especially when there's a limited pool of funds to distribute and some will be arguably unjustly enriched at the expense of others?
Yeah, I mean, those are obviously tough questions, and I don't pretend to say that, look, if the government takes victims' rights seriously, every victim of fraud is going to get 100% recovery on, you know, every dollar that they lost. That just isn't going to be the case. And somebody has to ultimately make the decision about, in a vast fraud, which parts of the fraud are we going to go to the mat on, which victims are we going to give priority to. And, of course, in our system of separated powers, that's ultimately got to be the prosecutor. But there are some checks on that. I mean, I don't think the prosecution should just be able to cut out a bunch of victims without at least talking to the victims about what they're doing. Maybe the victims could say, look, we would encourage you, let the guy plead to count one, but obligate him to make, you know, restitution on counts 2, 3, and 4. Or can you structure a deal where there's a pool of money that all the victims can tap into? If the government, after hearing those requests, ultimately decides it can't do that or there are good reasons not to do that, then so be it. I mean, that may just be what has to happen in some cases. Of course, the victims would have the right to go in front of a judge and urge the judge to reject a plea agreement that didn't provide fair restitution or fair arrangements along those lines, and that's another check that we have there. One of the things that's strange about the particular case I've been talking about, though, is the defendant did plead guilty to the entire fraud, or a vast fraud, and then the government simply decided to ignore that guilty plea when it was convenient for them later on, and that I think that isn't a question of hard choices being made. I think that's just a question. That's just a situation where the government has decided to ignore its obligations, and they shouldn't be able to do that.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines are open. Let's take another call.
Judge Cassell, Mike Tremolia with the Philadelphia chapter. I'm a journalist, not a lawyer. We've corresponded in the past by email. How does this tie in with a accusation about Loretta Lynch being in her office being described as a major forfeiture operation? Is there any link to that? And also, on the area of victims' rights, tangential to this issue, it seems to me that victims' rights advocates are rarely called before panels to determine the wisdom of early release programs, and I was just wondering if you could comment on that.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Mike. Those are two good questions. First, on the forfeiture issue, I mean, I know there have been. I'm familiar, of course, with the competing views on that, and I'm assuming that will be an area of questioning for her tomorrow. I have to say that I think those are different than the issues that we're looking at here. Those are suggestions that the U.S. Attorney's Office has used its vast power to harm innocent defendants, or at least defendants in some ways that at least some people think are unfair. And so I'll let those questions be answered in their own right. I think that the victims' issues are separate. You also raise an interesting point. Why is it that we rarely hear from victims? You mentioned early release programs. you know, it looks like on the list of panelists who will be speaking on Thursday on the Lynch nomination, for example, there aren't any representatives for crime victims groups. And I think the problem there is that, frankly, crime victims groups just are not all that well organized politically, unlike other groups where you know ahead of time who is in the group and who isn't in the group, you know, a labor union or some other organization like that, where it's obvious you know, people have collective interests that can obviously be organized in a way that allows them to make points in the political forum. People who are victimized don't ask to become crime victims, and a lot of victims are not politically well connected. Oftentimes, we know that victims of crime come from lower socioeconomic status. We know that minority groups are disproportionately affected by crime, and so sadly, crime victims groups just are not as politically effective, I think, as other groups, and that leads, I think, unfortunately, to their voice not being heard in situations where it should be heard. And perhaps the case we've been talking about is one illustration of that.
Okay, thanks very much.
Let me make another call for questions. Our lines are completely open now. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've still got some time left here. Here's one more question. Let's see what's on this caller's mind.
Paul, this is Fred Oberlander. I have a question for you. Most of us, I would imagine, remember almost exactly a year ago that it was a topic of popular culture that the character Jordan Belfort behind the Wolf of Wall Street movie apparently had a $100 million restitution order on him, but other than what he had forfeited at the time of arrest, had paid very little. It turns out that the same is true of his co-conspirator in the case. I forget the gentleman's name. But the question I have for you is that it further turns out that the judge, and I have not been able to pull the formal documents, I have secondary court documents related to this, but apparently in the Belfort case, the judge ordered a restitution pool for victims, and that's the $100 million order, but said, and it was originally funded with the $10 million or whatever forfeiture, but the judge built into his order that any victim who applied for and received any money of any kind from that pool, by doing so, was waiving all rights to sue Mr. Belfort or anybody to whom he might have made fraudulent transfers or conveyances. And at least one victim objected and was shot down by the state court in which he brought the lawsuit, claiming that, oh no, the moment you took a few dollars from the restitution fund, you've, according to what the court decided, you have completely forfeited all civil rights against Mr. Belfort, his wife, and anybody else that he might have hidden his assets with. I was wondering if you could comment on that, because while I am in no position to know how that order came about, it certainly sounds suspicious to me that it's an agreement with the defendant to say, look, we need your cooperation. And one of the things we'll do for you is we'll fashion, if you agree to plead guilty, we'll fashion a restitution order that will protect and cover all the money you stuck away in the trust for your wife and children, which is something they typically do. Do you have any thoughts about whether that offends either the letter or the spirit of the MVRA and CVRA? The MVRA,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question, Fred. And let me be clear, I'm going to speak as a matter of federal law. I don't know if there's some quirky provision in New York law that may or may not be different. But certainly as a matter of federal law, what the kind of arrangement that you're describing would be absolutely illegal. Federal law is very clear. If, let's say, somebody has stolen, you know, $1 million and now the victim receives restitution of $100,000 or something, that does not in any way preclude their ability to seek full recovery. There's a provision of law, it's in the Restitution Procedures Act 3664J like jump, that says there is an offset. Let me be clear, you don't get to double recover. You can't get, you know, $1 million in restitution for $1 million loss and then go sue somebody and collect $2 million on a $1 million loss. But until you or a victim's been satisfied, there is no barrier to pursuing simultaneously both a civil action and a restitution action. The problem, of course, as we've discussed earlier today, a lot of times a victim, if they don't get restitution, really isn't going to be in a position to seek some kind of a civil recovery. And so the choice is often between restitution or no recovery whatsoever. The arrangement that you described, though, I don't see any authority for a judge to require a victim to waive their right to sue as a precondition to accessing a restitution fund.
Well, you understand the reason I mention it is it was entirely federal, and in fact in the Eastern District, shocking, and yet there are cases from the Eastern District that expressly hold that no matter what kind of a civil recovery you've had, even if in your civil recovery you have discharged all of the civil liability, that has nothing to do other than as a dollar offset against your ability to obtain an order of restitution, which is not civil, but it's part of the criminal sentencing scheme. And that's why I mentioned it, because it is deeply disturbing to me to see federal judges saying, if you want to get any restitution, give up your rights to sue, when I think I understand you to be saying that seems deeply suspicious in terms of either the motive, efficacy, or both. I didn't mean to put it in your mouth.
I mean, obviously, I'd want to know all the details before opining on a particular case, but so let me just speak generally. I don't see any authority in federal law for a judge to condition receipt of restitution on the willingness of a victim to waive their right to pursue civil recovery. And just thinking in terms of first principles here, that can't be the way to administer the restitution statute, because the goal of the restitution statute is to ensure that victims get full recovery. And to say that if you take partial recovery, you're going to forfeit your right to get full recovery would be at odds with the very purpose of these statutes. So I don't want to comment or criticize any particular judge or any particular case not knowing all the facts, but speaking in general terms, I don't see any authority in the federal restitution laws for that kind of a waiver requirement.
Well, you understand I mention it also because I have found it's extremely common with these financial fraud defendants that when they know that they are facing a restitution order, that they use the intervening time between arrest and eventual sentencing to squirrel away assets.
Sure.
It's virtually always done. And perhaps if I could ask you your thoughts on whether any subsequent statutory amendment should include some type of equivalent that they would do. It's my understanding that with a criminal forfeiture, that there must be a criminal charge of forfeiture in the charging instrument for constitutional notice. But at that point, the U.S. attorney can ask for a pre-sentencing remedy of either seizure or lien or something. Why wouldn't the same be effective or an advisable supplement to the laws for victims' rights?
Yeah, what you're talking about, I think, are sometimes called, you know, sort of clawback features. To what extent can a trustee or a court claw back money that may or may not have dissipated over a period of time? And I think that's an important issue, that there are provisions in federal law right now that allow some degree of clawback, but I think the general sense is that those provisions could be strengthened. So I think you've raised a very good issue that Congress ought to be investigating more carefully.
Thank you.
Let me make a final call for questions here. If you have a question for Paul Cassell, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are still open. We've still got some time left. If anybody has a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask you one question, Professor. I've been in the Inspector General community in federal government a couple times in smaller agencies. Is this an issue that should be or would be of interest to the Department of Justice Inspector General?
I think it would be because it does look like certainly the implementation of several federal statutes, the Crime Victims' Rights Act and the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act, is called into question. And I know ordinarily the Inspector General tries to ferret out situations involving government fraud that maybe affects the taxpayers. That's at the top of the list. But this is an issue that affects the crime victims, and I certainly think it falls within the mandate of the Inspector General, and perhaps they can take a look at whether these statutes are operating the way they were intended to operate.
Looks like we don't have any further questions. Let me give you a minute or two to express any final thoughts you might have, Professor.
Yeah, just one last thought. I hope that there may be some people listening that are involved with the confirmation process, and we'll figure out a way to ask Ms. Lynch questions about this subject. As I say, she seems to have done a number of good things in her career. I'm certainly not saying that this particular one is disabling or anything like that. That would be a judgment call for others to make, but I do think that she should be asked questions about this, and hopefully that will give us insight as to what kind of an attorney general she would be, and maybe insight into the way these cases are being handled in the Eastern District of New York and elsewhere.
Well, Judge Professor Paul Cassell, thank you so much for your time today. I certainly appreciate the discussion here. To our audience, thank you as well, and thank you for your questions. And a reminder that our next scheduled telephone conference call is tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking about the Keystone case that was resolved by the Nebraska Supreme Court. That's tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. But until that next telephone conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.